Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studna, Associate Editor for Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm here today with our Editor-in-Chief, Lisa Henderson. For today's episode, we are speaking with Christine McSherry, CEO of Casimir, and Mindy Leffler, President and Chairman of Casimir.
Prior to joining Casimir in 2017, Christine founded Jet Foundation, which is named for her son, Jet, who is now 27, and she founded it in 2001 when he was diagnosed with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, also known as DMD. As head of the Jet Foundation, Christine also co-founded the International Duchenne Alliance, which has funded nearly $40 million in research to date. She has 30 years of experience and expertise as a registered nurse, as well as experience in outcome measure development and regulatory affairs in clinical trials.
Mindy joined Casimir in 2016, following 7 years at Auris. With her experience in project management and software development, Mindy designed a PRO program for her son, which proved instrumental in the FDA review of eteplirsen, the first FDA-approved treatment for Duchenne. Using her experience as a member of the patient and caregiver community, Mindy utilizes an approach that engages patients, KOLs, and regulators to develop more meaningful endpoints in a range of neuromuscular and neurodevelopmental disorders. So with that, thank you both for joining us on today's episode.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So as we said in the intro, you both have deep personal connections to the Duchenne community. And Christine, you founded the Jet Foundation and then co-founded the International Duchenne Alliance, which is a partnership of 40 other independent organizations. So I just wanted to get a sense of how large is the Duchenne community? And then with these 40 independent organizations, how effectively do you join and communicate as a unified voice?
So the Duchenne Alliance probably started back in about 2011, 2012, when a number of these smaller nonprofit organizations came together and couldn't figure out why we kept duplicating each other's efforts, why we were not communicating, why were we not collaborating together to fund projects. And this was a time where there was really only one clinical trial in Duchenne, and that was by PTC Therapeutics, and Sarepta, the eteplirsen drug, was just underway in the United Kingdom and was struggling. And so myself and a number of different organizations pulled together what we called the Duchenne Alliance, which, as you said, has 40 plus members. It really came together and was much more powerful at the time of the review of eteplirsen, because we had formed a connection and we were communicating on a monthly or quarterly basis. It enabled us to have that groundswell effect in the Duchenne community for us all to come together to support what we thought would be the first drug approved in Duchenne history. Since that time, we have had to work with each other occasionally, but we function much better now as a community group. We're not in silos. We help each other. So Jet Foundation has turned more into a service organization, and I have some organizations that now donate and help provide those services for us, whether it be camp or equipment for patients and families. And then there's ways in which we lend ourselves to other organizations. So if there's advocacy needs or regulatory needs from the community, PPMD, Parent Project Muscular Dystrophy, will reach out to Jet Foundation for our support in those endeavors. So while we don't operate as a fully blown cohesive organization anymore, what we learned and what we do is that we leverage each other either financially, politically, or for whatever it is that we need. We know who does it best and we go to those people. So I don't want to act as though we're still meeting on an annual basis. We're not, but we are collectively all talking to each other and working together. And when there's problems, we're able to come together now and solve them instead of being afraid of being in somebody else's territory. Far less territorial, that's what I'll say.
Excellent. So is that how you and Mindy met, Christine?
No, that's not how we met.
Okay.
Mindy and I met, actually, Mindy, when did we actually meet?
Actually, at FDA. I had connected with Abigail Alliance, which is an organization that's dedicated to improving access to experimental treatments. A man named Frank Burrows started it when his daughter Abigail was diagnosed with a type of cancer, and he was trying to get her into a clinical trial for a drug that's now standard of care for her type of cancer that she was diagnosed with. And I reached out to him just to kind of understand the regulatory landscape a little bit better. when some trials in Duchenne were moving forward, and he offered, you know, to help us if we ever needed it. And so he's the one that really provided entree into FDA. And so that's when Christine and I met, was the first time that we went to FDA, when Abigail Alliance had those doors opened for us to start talking about drug conduct and approvals in rare disease.
I would say too that social media played a really big role in bringing Mindy and I together, but also in terms of the community together. So we started learning about how a drug was being efficacious via social media for me. And it was, we were able to open up communication channels that way. So I think, you know, while the evolution of social media sometimes is branded as a bad thing, in rare disease, it's often the place where rare disease parents or families can have those lines of communication open and kind of speed things along a little bit.
Yeah, that's an excellent observation. Thanks for sharing that.
So both of you appeared to be very driven toward the patient and power voices for FDA and in developing PROs. Christine, you started the last question. So Mindy, if you want to start this one, can you explain that journey and specifically around the patient and caregiver and the regulators?
Yeah, absolutely. So it really starts with the first clinical trial that my son participated in. I was pretty naive when we got started, you know, thinking that, you know, if something had progressed to the clinical trial stage, you know, that surely it had been really well thought through and appropriate decisions had been made. You know, we're obviously studying something in children. And when I showed up, you know, to be randomized in my son's first clinical trial, you know, it just became immediately apparent that that wasn't the case. You know, this was a clinical trial that took place in Vancouver, Canada. So, you know, I had signed our family up to fly from Seattle to Vancouver every Wednesday for the next 48 weeks. And this drug that was being investigated had injection site reactions. And when we showed up to be randomized the very first day, you know, my son was waiting because another little boy went in to get randomized and injected before him. And when he came out, he said it felt like sharks were biting his arm. He told my son that. So my son is 8 years old at the time and now terrified that he has to go in and experience that. And the other mom came out and said, you know, they put the needle in and he didn't feel a thing. And as soon as they started plunging the meds in, he started screaming. And so, you know, we had to drag my son into the room to get injected, and the nurses were holding him down and they put the needle in his arm and they plunged the medication in, and he hopped off my lap and said, I didn't feel a thing. And that's when we knew that we had essentially signed ourselves up to, you know, go get a saline shot every Wednesday for the next 48 weeks and subject him to two muscle biopsies, you know, done under general anesthesia while he was on a placebo, because there really wasn't any integrity to the blind. And so that was really my first experience in wanting to get more involved in the way that studies were being designed and the way that they were taking the patient experience into account in a way that made sense and treated, you know, families like ours, you know, ethically and still capturing the data that we needed to with rigor.
What year was that, Mindy?
Oh my gosh, 2012, I want to say. It was quite a while ago. Yeah, and then our next experience in that study was, you know, essentially the outcome measure in use was a 6-minute walk. And, you know, there were boys in that study, like my son, that walked over 500 meters in the 6-minute walk. And then there were boys in the study that walked 50 meters in the 6-minute walk, and they were being randomized against each other. You know, in retrospect, there's no way that you can, you know, call those the same boy in terms of how well they might potentially respond to a treatment, you know, in terms of the way that they're going to perform even in receiving a potentially efficacious treatment. So in retrospect, it was a really problematic study design. But in addition, just the use of the 6-minute walk, you know, it's an outcome measure that, you know, was designed to measure exercise intolerance in adult cardiac patients. And so, you know, you apply it to, you know, 8-year-old boys, 30% of whom are on the autism spectrum, you know, and ask them to walk as far as they can in 6 minutes, you know, I think it's problematic on the face of it, you know, and, you know, most boys with Duchenne don't really prioritize exercise, you know, as one of their really meaningful outcomes. You know, they want to walk from their classroom to the lunchroom, you know, in their elementary school. You know, they don't want to exercise. I mean, they want to play with their friends and participate in sports, you know, and things like that, you know, if they could choose. But the selection of the 6-minute walk, you know, as something that was borrowed from adult cardiovascular disease was problematic as well. So that was really what led me to get interested in thinking through how we could measure change in Duchenne in a way that was meaningful to patients and their families.
And just to comment on that, my experience as a nurse back in the early 1990s, late 80s, when HIV was prevalent, I had patients that would come in and they would die within 3 months. And at the time, Janet Woodcock was working with David Kessler, who was then the commissioner of the FDA, on something called accelerated approval. And I remember actually being in a patient's room who had HIV and watching Janet on TV. And this didn't come back to me until many, many years later when I was sitting at FDA and I was like, huh, I remember seeing her on TV when I was a young nurse. And I think what I started to do is I started to apply some of the things that I learned back then, which is, hey, Dr. Noble, our patient in 213 got up and brushed his teeth today. And Jim Noble would be like, well, okay, what does that mean? And I'm like, it means that
LabVantage Solutions is a global leader in enterprise laboratory software solutions that improve customer outcomes by transforming data into knowledge. Its intelligent LIMS platform features advanced analytics, state-of-the-art AI, and mixed reality technologies that enable revolutionary advances in the pharmaceutical industry by drawing greater insights from broad data sets. For more information, visit labvantage.com.
And I'm like, it means that he's getting better or she's getting better. Well, his labs don't look better. Yeah, but I can see the differences in the patient before the labs actually change, which is exactly what accelerated approval means and what it is. It's oftentimes you will see things change either before or after the clinical picture changes. And so the other piece to that was that those patients didn't have much time to live. And so if there was benefit, we wanted to identify that benefit as early as possible. The same thing in Duchenne. When you're diagnosed with Duchenne, they're telling you that you have less, your child has less than 20 years to live. If you're going to give that time to a clinical trial, that time really needs to be valued. And if there are changes that are happening, we need to know about them. So we can either continue treatment or drug or study, or we can stop and stop wasting that family's time because it's not working, because that's all they have. And that's one thing you can never give back.
I'm sure you're aware that FDA has, in just the last couple of years, you know, put forth guidance about capturing the more important information from the patients and caregivers, the parents. Do you see that translating at all? Do you think anything has improved?
I can speak to that. So I think FDA has really been doing some groundbreaking work on putting together this vision for patient-focused drug development. And it starts, you know, with building this foundation, you know, of making sure that the patient's view is integrated from the very outset of study planning in terms of outcome measure development and selection. And I think that eventually, you know, everyone that follows that guidance, you know, will end up doing exactly the things that Christine and I have been advocating for years, making sure that their voices are incorporated all along. I think right now we're in a place where there are legacy instruments, you know, that are utilized because people are familiar with them, because they're validated, because there are large existing data sets, you know, with those legacy instruments. And there are also people doing what we're trying to do, which is to develop novel instruments that take that patient-focused guidance that FDA has laid out, you know, and utilize that from the outset. And so we're in this kind of hybrid stage where both are available, you know, these novel instruments and these legacy instruments. And so I think companies that utilize both approaches and make sure that in their regulatory engagement that they're, you know, potentially going over some of the shortcomings of the legacy instruments and the promise of the novel instruments, you know, and coming up with, you know, statistical analysis plans that incorporate both into kind of their thresholds for defining success. Where the outcome measure that we're working on in Duchenne, you know, really did start with that patient-focused drug development in mind. I mean, it essentially started with marching orders from a conversation with FDA where we were bringing in evidence and several members at FDA said, you know, this is really a great approach. You guys should pursue this. It just needs to be done in a way that's standardized and rigorous and validated. But essentially what it started with was us having conversations with parents and saying, how do you know if your son's getting weaker? How do you know if your son's getting stronger? And they would say, well, I think he's getting a little weaker because, you know, when he's eating his meals now, he's, you know, he's got his fork in one hand and he's got his other hand under his wrist. So he's using both arms to get his food to his mouth. So I know he's getting a little weaker. So it was really that caregiver feedback that articulated, okay, this is what we need to quantify. We need to quantify these little changes in movement patterns that are indicative of progressive weakness. You know, and if we do that, you know, maybe we can do that in a way that will be faster than something like the 6-minute walk and more meaningful. And so, like I said, there are a lot of people kind of developing these novel instruments. And as they continue to be developed, you know, with that PFDD foundation from regulatory, I think they'll be used more and more often moving forward.
So what was your impetus for founding Casmere?
Really, as Mindy said, it was that conversation and collaboration kind of with FDA. It was bringing back FDA some data that we had collected and having them take a look at that data and saying, hey, wow, you know what? Maybe these boys in this heterogeneous population in this rare disease where we don't have these large numbers, maybe some boys change in some areas and some boys change in other areas, like on this medication. And it was really kind of understanding that, as Mindy said, like you can compare a boy who can do 50 meters in a 6-minute walk test or over 500 in a 6-minute walk test. But at the end of the day, like you can't always match your cohorts. This disease progresses somewhat differently. We can predict how it's going to progress, but somewhat differently in different patients. And so therefore we need that really, that personalized approach to each patient. And when we were able to bring back evidence to FDA and show them through video that patient A was getting better in a different way than patient B, I think at least the leadership at FDA began to understand that. And that was when the suggestion was made that, you know, maybe you should go do this for not only Duchenne, but in other diseases as well. And so that's what we did.
The original situation that kind of gave rise to the process that Christine's describing is that there was a study in Duchenne that was put on clinical hold and eventually discontinued. And, you know, as we were talking to parents whose kids were participating in that study, you know, a lot of those boys were looking pretty strong. There are boys in Duchenne who are kind of stronger, more functional kids, but there were a lot of them in this study. And so we started collecting videos with those families. And what we started noticing is that these boys were picking up these compensatory patterns that we felt were indicative of weakness. You know, a boy would go up the stairs right after he got withdrawn from drug, you know, without having to push off his thighs or use the arm rails to get up the stairs. And then, you know, 8 weeks later, you know, he's having to push off his thighs and use the stairs. And so that was really kind of the pivotal point where we decided, okay, I think this is something that we can quantify. And so that's when we set about, you know, putting the rigor in place that FDA wanted. So, you know, putting capture procedures into place that guide the families on how to capture those videos, testing those capture procedures, making sure that people understand them, and then, you know, developing the technology that we needed for them to do it from the home so that we're really looking into their daily lives rather than getting a window into how they might be performing in clinic after, you know, flying across the country potentially. You know, and then coming up with scorecards, you know, that were validated by physical therapists to help us quantify what we were seeing on those videos, you know, and developing a training program to certify those physical therapists so that they can perform as raters. You know, it's been a tremendous amount of work to take that concept and turn it into something that FDA would view as sufficiently rigorous to be used in a trial.
You sound like pioneers in a couple things, in a lot of things, actually, you know, the patient-focused drug development, like you said, you know, finding those outcomes, and now pioneers of decentralized trials, which is such a talked about term now, but you were actually like doing that before it was even a vogue, you know, so yeah. I just wanted to make that comment, but
just to add on to that, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, Christine and I have always felt that, you know, there's something about putting a kid with Duchenne on the airplane, you know, there's something vasoconstrictive or they just get weak when you put them on a plane. And so everybody, you know, has long been talking about decreasing patient burden and participating in clinical trials. I mean, like I said, my family flew from Seattle to Vancouver every Wednesday for 2 years, and it was not easy. So, yeah. I mean, everybody's on board with reducing burden for patients, but we were really pushing for home-based capture for data integrity reasons as well, just because, you know, there are so many diseases where, you know, you can't take a boy that drives 20 minutes to clinic and randomize him against a kid that flies across the country, you know, and pretend that that doesn't affect the way that the data turns out at the end of the day.
I was just going to say, it also just kind of makes sense, right? Like we're interested in how a patient gets off of their chair at home versus in the clinic. Like we want to see, as Mindy probably is going to say, the more habitual way of moving and performing tasks in your home, because that's your environment, not a sterile environment of a clinic or a strange environment. So we want, how do people function in their own home? How do they get their mail? How do they climb their stairs? How do they turn on their light, you know, above their bed or whatever the task might be? It's applicable because it's functional in your own home.
Well, and I think the other piece of the remote data capture, you know, story is that at the end of the day, we all want to expand clinical trial participation to groups that might not have it, you know, be accessible to them. You know, maybe they don't have paid vacation days to take off work to be able to travel to a study site or bring their child to a study site. You know, so anything that you can do to transition the conduct of a clinical trial to remote in the patient's home, you know, you're going to expand the number of people that can participate and take a more equity-based approach to trial participation, which is really important as well.
So you took all of these measures that you've developed, that you grew your philosophies, you started Casimir, and now Casimir was purchased. Are you still a part of that CRO?
Yeah, we're super excited about being a part of MS. I think with any founders, it's always really important to stop and take stock of, you know, where your strengths are and where you could use some support from other people. I think Christina and I have tried to do that from the very, very beginning. We've never pretended to have, you know, PhDs in psychometrics. And so I think at the point at which, you know, we looked around and said, you know, there are some ways in which, you know, we could kind of plug in the gaps in terms of experience that we need. You know, we have a whole biostats department that we have access to and things like that with the merger with MS. That's really exciting. So we get to integrate, you know, the approach that we were taking at Casimir, and, you know, we get to take advantage of these groups with vast amounts of expertise. We also have the ability now with the merger with MS, you know, to run end-to-end interventional studies, you know, so we weren't a CRO that could run pharmacy, you know, and randomize patients and, you know, run a study end-to-end. And with the combination with MS and the Orphan Reach team, you know, we have the ability to combine our expertise in remote data capture and novel outcome measure development, you know, with the conduct of end-to-end interventional clinical trials with a group that has expertise in doing that specific to rare disease. So it's a super exciting merger for us.
Yeah, it was also really personal for us too. So basically the DVA, Duchenne Video Assessment that we built was really built off of our experiences and the experiences from our community, which we're very close to. And for me, my son is, while he stabilized in his disease, he continues to progress in his disease. And so, not to be morbid, but he's going to have a shortened lifespan. And I wanted to partner with somebody who had a more global outreach than Mindy and I had, because it became very personal to build something off of children who have a terminal disease. You want to make sure that it has every opportunity to succeed and to become hopefully a game changer in this disease and change the trajectory of many lives. And so for me, it was the opportunity to have that global footprint and the strength and the capacity to grow it, because it's rooted so personally for me and my son. And it's been a great fit, and we've been extraordinarily happy. And I feel very lucky and blessed that we found the right partner.
That's great. Thank you both for sharing. Now, when you first started on the CRO journey or prior, what were the largest barriers or challenges in operating a business in, Christine, like you just said, a very personal environment? So Mindy, how about we start with you on this one?
I think that one of the challenges, and you know, this is really kind of structural or organizational challenge in the beginning, was that people were really skeptical of home-based data capture when we got started. And the sites that we were working with, you know, to try and get our video assessment implemented in some of these studies, the sites were really overburdened. You know, there were a lot of people that were entering the space in Duchenne, a lot of companies that wanted to run studies through a small number of trial sites. And so we responded to that challenge by essentially setting up, you know, a clinical research organization that had the ability to basically take that burden off the sites. So we have a group of amazing study managers and study coordinators that specialize in home-based, you know, or remote data capture. And it really is kind of it's a different animal than clinically captured data, because you're essentially partnering with families in a way that's very different. You know, you go to clinic, you know, with your child to be assessed, or you go to clinic to be assessed yourself, and you really just are guided through that process by the study coordinator. And it's spelled out, you know, by the protocol. When you're doing remote data capture, you know, obviously it's still spelled out by the protocol in a very specific way, but you're partnering with the family to get that data collected and captured. You know, that takes, you know, forging of relationships in a way that our study coordinators, you know, are really good at. And so we get really good numbers on compliance and retention because we focused on that. So, you know, I think that was kind of the main organizational challenge, you know, that we found when we got started and just resulted in building out that infrastructure.
From my perspective, one of the obstacles was just being naive in the space, trying to apply what a parent and maybe a nurse perspective into a very rigid, already put together what we thought in the community was already a tight ship, mm-hmm. right? So trying to, a lot of what Mindy said, but for me, it was like, but no, I'm looking at this when I look at my son, and trying to get that perspective across to the KOLs, into other people in the space, and to kind of get them out of the lens of that real traditional look and feel of a clinical trial. And then to be honest with you, COVID kind of helped us with that because all of a sudden, you know, people realized that things could be done remotely. And we had this virtual world that we had to set up. You know, we were forced to set up because of COVID, but then your study site started asking, well, can we do some of these assessments at home? So I think that there were some blessings in COVID, as much as lots of tragedies, but one of the blessings was, okay, yeah, there is a way to be able to capture what's happening in the home. It is meaningful, and we can do this for the long term instead of having the burden of always going into clinic or going to different cities or different countries.
I was going to add just really quickly too that I think to a certain extent, you know, we had to battle, you know, impressions that, you know, we were a couple of moms that were just putting some video, you know, on the phone. You know, what we've designed and built, you know, is, you know, entirely validated outcome measure, you know, with a lot of rigor behind it. Like I mentioned, you know, we have capture procedures that guide the capture, you know, we have minimum scoring specifications, we have data monitors that monitor all videos that come in to see if they meet the scoring criteria. You know, so I think additionally, one of the challenges that I think we faced was that, you know, aren't these moms cute? You know, they're putting things on video and then everybody's watching their videos. And we had to kind of make sure that we were, you know, publishing our data so that everybody understood, you know, no, there's really a lot of work that goes into this and, you know, and a lot of structure that's put into the way that these outcomes work. So countering that impression, I think, was probably another challenge that I would list.
I could definitely see that. So you are both very accomplished and you have a lot on your plate. So what are some of your other goals in the near future?
From the outcome measure development side, you know, we want to pursue qualification for the Duchenne video assessment. We're in the qualification pathway at FDA. And so we want to get our qualification plan submitted, you know, get that feedback back from FDA so that we can tailor our program to, you know, any changes or advice, feedback that they provide to us. And then we want to see what other neuromuscular areas that we can extend that approach to, because I think there are a lot of other disease areas that are in the same situation now that Duchenne was in, you know, 7 years ago, you know, which is that they're not certain what outcome measures are going to best serve their population. And if this is a solution that could potentially help those communities, you know, we want to do that as fast as possible. And then secondary to that, we have an outcome measure that we're designing that's very similar in that it's home-based video capture, but it's neurodevelopmental in nature. So we're working on developing it in Angelman syndrome. And so the goal there is to make sure that those scorecards are built out and validated. You know, we're midway through that process, but it's looking really exciting so far because they're in a similar situation where they're borrowing general neurodevelopmental scales, you know, and having something Angelman specific will be great. And then the next task is to extend that into other neurodevelopmental diseases. So those are the goals in front of, you know, my team right now.
And the goals for me are really to ensure that, at least for the Duchenne community, that people don't make the same mistakes over and over again. So I spend a lot of my time talking with companies that are in the space or coming into the space to make sure that they have knowledge of mistakes that have been made so that they don't make them again. My goal is to get everyone in the Duchenne space using the Duchenne video assessment because I do think it is the most sensitive tool over a short period of time that we can demonstrate whether or not a drug is efficacious. Beyond that, I think that there's probably a handful of drugs out there that have probably worked in Duchenne, but we were using the wrong tool to measure it. So I'm interested in taking a look at those drugs and whether or not they might be efficacious combined with some current treatments and really just have respect for all those patients that participated in all those studies who have since died and don't know whether or not they contributed to the science or not. Those are some pretty heavy goals, lofty goals, but those are the things that I'd like to work on.
What piece of advice could you give to our audience of clinical trials operations professionals? Christine, let's start with you on this one.
So I think partnering with your patient advocacy groups should be the priority, so that you can better understand what their priorities are if there's when they're entering into a study for their community. Having somebody internally who understands the landscape, the patient landscape, and the patient journey, anticipating those and planning for those is really, really important. All diseases have their challenges, you know, whether it's diabetes or whether it's, you know, something as common as diabetes or something less common like Duchenne. But all of those communities have obstacles and challenges that our operations team needs to really understand. So partnering with the advocacy groups, attending those community meetings, annual community meetings, to better understand the patient journey is really, really important. And then incorporating all of those learnings into your studies. These, we call them patients, but they're really participants, number one. Number two, the data that they're giving us is gold. So we need to treat it like that. Number three, we're taking time away from people that don't have time to give. And so we need to be respectful of that time. And those partnerships can make a difference when you listen and then implement what you're hearing. It's really important.
I think I would just reinforce what Christine's saying and add to it and say, you know, there's a difference between having a conversation with somebody in a disease community and then checking that box and saying, okay, we're done, and really substantively listening to that community and understanding the ways in which what they have to say affect your data collection. And also understanding that not every patient that you talk to is the same as another patient. You know, if you want to get somebody's opinion on, you know, the use of muscle biopsies in a neuromuscular clinical trial, you're going to get different feedback from people that have had a biopsy versus people that haven't had a biopsy. You know, so it's not enough just to say, I talked to this patient community. You know, it's understanding what is the specific experience of this patient that I'm talking to? How representative is it of the entire disease population? You know, who else do I need to talk to make sure that I have, you know, a really representative perspective, you know, across the spectrum of experience within those patients? You know, and then it's just understanding, how do I take what I'm hearing from these families and understand how it's going to affect, you know, a clinical trial? And, you know, I'll give an example from a not so rare condition. You know, Christine and I did a study in hearing loss where we talked to patients, you know, about outcome measures used in hearing loss, you know, huge population in that study. And the interesting thing is, you know, one of the main outcomes used in that population is the words and noise test, you know, where you are trying to decipher words that are spoken in the midst of background noise. But the interesting thing when they talk to the families is that people have all different frequencies of hearing loss. So some people have trouble hearing high-pitched voices. Some people have trouble hearing low-pitched voices. And the thinking is that, oh, we just standardize the voice that people hear in the words and noise tests. But the variable that that creates is that some people are going to have an easier time hearing that particular voice's frequency than other people. And so that washes out in a really huge study. But understanding how that type of experience affects data collection in rare disease is key, because the devil's in those details in small studies. And they can blow up a data set if you're not really aware of the ways in which, you know, patients experience your study, the ways in which patients interact with your outcome measure, and the way that the analysis is performed at the end of the day. You know, that patient feedback, you know, needs to be taken seriously enough that you dig into it to understand the ways in which it's going to affect the outcomes of the study.
I have one more, which is sometimes when you're a rare disease patient in a study, we call it an investigational product. You don't want to promise that it's going to have efficacy, keep the data locked down. But at some point in that study, that investigational product may become a treatment if those patients are beginning to feel better. And so that becomes their now medicine in their mind and in their family's way of life. Well, you're feeling better now. We have to go get your medicine. It turns into their medicine. And for some families, often families, it becomes their lifeline. So if they see that the drug is working, or their child is feeling better, or their child is behaving better because of it, it really does become their lifeline. And so when we take that lifeline away, because we don't see what we want to see in the data, maybe we're using those more legacy outcome measures that Mindy talked about, what happens? What gets reflected? What does that child now think that we took the medicine away? And we don't often think about those failed clinical studies and the trauma that it induces on that child or that family. And also during the study itself, that if it's efficacious, and even if they're only showing a small amount of improvement, to them it's medicine now. And so we do have to look at, in these rare diseases, how we approach them, how we talk about them, the language that we put around them, and then understand what happens if the data doesn't show what we think it's going to show, what happens to that family post-study.
Thank you for the advice. I'm sure that our audience will definitely appreciate all that. Now, is there anything else that either of you would like to add that maybe we haven't covered yet with the questions that we've already been through?
As a parent, I'll tell this story. My son, when he was in middle school, you know, woke up one morning with chest pain, and it was different when he's laid down than when he sat up. And that can be indicative of fluid buildup around the heart. And, you know, with Duchenne, you kind of never know. And I remember thinking to myself, well, okay, it's going down. Here we go. You know, this is, you know, you've been waiting for it since his diagnosis. And here we are, you know, in the midst of it, you know, and you go into kind of fight or flight mode and you try and figure it out. And we eventually ended up figuring out that it was discomfort in his chest wall. And it's happened a couple of times since, you know, because they get muscular cramps pretty frequently. So it was kind of chest wall muscle rather than cardiac issue. But then once you figure it out, you know, you're expected as a parent to go out into the world. And my middle child's elementary school had this family third Thursday where you go visit the kids' classroom. And we were supposed to be folk dancing in his PE class. You know? And so I'm literally just coming from this cardiac scare, you know, thinking, okay, well, here we go. This is the beginning of the end for my son with Duchenne, to, you know, a half an hour later having to like folk dance with these parents in this PE class. You know, you just get so used to just like cramming it into this, you know, place inside you where, you know, you just put it away and do what you need to do to get through what's in front of you. So I think we're both pretty used to that. It doesn't get easier, you know, you just know how to do it better, I guess. I guess that is easier. It's painful each time you do it, but you know, it's what you have to do to make progress.
Yeah, it's a good point though, Mindy, about the other kids, right? So you're living this really abnormal life with your son that is sick. And like I said, knowingly, I can say this out loud, my son is going to have a very limited lifespan, and you try to normalize it somehow to be like the rest of society. And it's just, it's a very awkward way to live. So, yeah. You know, I think when people see my son in his power chair, they don't think about the 2 hours of work that I had to do to get him into his power chair, you mm-hmm. know, like the lifting or like over the weekend, he caught a stomach bug and he can't walk to the toilet himself. And so it's 2 or 3 times up at night to get him to a toilet. And, you know, you literally have to carry a 27-year-old. I mean, yeah. And then you get up the next morning and the combat pest guy is at your door and he's like, I'm here to, you know, I'm your pest man. I'm like, okay, sure, come on in. You just keep going. It's a heck of a story though, if anybody ever wants to write a book.
You could add that to your list of meaningful accomplishments that you've already achieved. So thank you for being with us and sharing all this. Greatly appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.